thought that was quite an insight. So this is the supposed beginning of wisdom. In fact, this was an international literary trend. And we have examples from Egypt and from other Near Eastern, ancient Near Eastern cultures that have very similar kinds of advice. It wasn't restricted to Israel alone, but of course Israel put its own twist on it. So let's turn to the book of Proverbs. Proverbs. It's after Psalms.
After Psalms.
After Psalms.
It's around page 650 if you have one of the.
Thank you.
Those guys.
Yeah.
Page 650-ish.
Proverbs what?
Well, why don't you just turn, you could open the book almost any place to see examples of conventional wisdom, but how about Proverbs 15? Would someone like to read the first verse?
The plans of the mind belong to mortals, but the answer of the...
15?
A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger.
A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger.
True.
It's sort of common folk wisdom.
Still not followed, but common.
Yes.
I guess McCain and Obama haven't figured this out yet.
McCain, okay, let's... For coffee hour. Verse 2.
The tongue of the wise dispenses knowledge, but the mouths of fools pour out folly.
Notice how they juxtapose wisdom and folly. Wisdom and folly. This is a consistent, this is one of the hallmarks of the conventional wisdom. Verse 3.
The eyes of the Lord are in every place, keeping watch on the evil and the good.
Along with this idea come in conventional wisdom is that the just receive their rewards and riches and evildoers get their just punishment. Mm-hmm. That's conventional wisdom. When you look in the books of Job and Ecclesiastes, they come up with different answers and they challenge this conventional wisdom. That's what I think makes wisdom literature so exciting for me, is that there are these different strands and they dialogue back and forth across time. Well, you've gotten a sense of what conventional wisdom is. Let's turn to chapter 8, Proverbs 8. Let's see. What we're going to meet is the personification of wisdom, often referred to as woman wisdom. I'm going to read the introduction, the first three verses. Does not wisdom call, and does not understanding raise her voice? On the heights, beside the way, at the crossroads, she takes her stand. Beside the gates in front of the town, at the entrance of the portals, she cries out. Would you read verse 4?
Sure. To you, O people, I call, and my cry is to all that live.
Dan, could you take the next verse and we'll just go around?
O simple ones, learn prudence, acquire intelligence, you who lack it.
Hear, for I will speak noble things, and from my lips will come what is right. For my mouth will utter truth. Wickedness in an abomination to my lips, is an abomination to my lips.
8.
All the words of my mouth are righteous. There is nothing twisted or crooked in them.
They are all straight to one who understands, and right to those who find knowledge.
Take my instruction instead of silver, and knowledge rather than choice gold.
For wisdom is better than jewels.
and all that you may desire cannot compare with her.
Let's pause there. What have you learned about wisdom thus far?
It's feminine.
Feminine. Interesting. Why a feminine voice?
The wiser.
Because more soft-spoken?
Sorry? What did you say?
More soft-spoken.
More soft-spoken?
Women are than men.
All right.
Sometimes.
Maybe.
Sometimes.
Other thing? Anything else? What else?
Sometimes women are more inclined to develop a listening heart. Sometimes.
Sometimes, yes. And that's sort of the role that society often asks them to play. It's the emotional side in relationships, sometimes. Yeah.
And paying attention to everyone else and what
and
they're
their needs
thinking and needing and doing and on.
Okay.
I don't remember who Sophia was, but Sophia is associated with wisdom and is a feminine word in Persian, I guess.
Yes, well, Sophia is the Greek word for wisdom, which is what was used to translate the Hebrew, which is chokmah. So it's chokmah that's being used here. And yes, Sophia, this idea of this personification, Sophia, comes directly from the Hebrew Bible. Yeah. You had something.
Well, I think masculine male roles sort of tend more towards going out hunting, fighting, kind of that kind of action, while a woman is more traditionally domestic and kind of more maybe contemplative. So, and also, as you said, sort of kind of keeping an eye on everything that's happening, watching out, you know, what's going to go wrong here, that my child might be in danger or something. So it's sort of kind of watching.
All right.
And understand.
Well, you mentioned the word domestic, which is very interesting, because how is wisdom described? Where is she located?
Entrance to the portals.
Entrance to the portals. Beside the gates in front of the town. What happened at the gates in Israelite cities?
Justice. Court.
Justice. Yes, court. It was where people brought their grievances, and there was a public disputation and settlement of grievances. So she's right in the middle of civic discourse. She's planted herself there. Perhaps she hopes that someone will catch on. But she's calling out to people. So it's a very active role. You know, if you want to think, this, I think this figure of wisdom, yes, it's a feminine figure, and it also straddles those gender divides because she's very active. In fact, one could almost say seductive. If you keep reading these passages, and if you go into other wisdom books like Ben Sirach and The Wisdom of Solomon, she gets very seductive. Come, put your feet in her fetters. And your yoke upon her neck, or her collar around your neck. I mean, it just gets sexualized there. So, what else about wisdom? What's her value?
More than jewels.
More than jewels, more than silver, more than gold. Do you agree with the author?
No.
No?
Well, I mean, it's hard to agree with that, given you talk about today.
Mm-hmm.
Then I could say, yeah, I agree with you. Because not everybody had jewels and gold and all. But everybody has access to it today.
Oh.
I mean, you watch those Infra commercials, they're selling diamonds to poor people. I mean, you know, all that kind of thing.
Oh, interesting. Okay. All right. Well, what is the value of wisdom today? The kind of wisdom that they're talking about? Prudence. What does it require? It entails prudence, intelligence, truth,
discretion,
righteous words.
Mm-hmm.
Valuable?
Mm-hmm.
Valuable?
Scarce.
Uh-huh.
Valued? I wonder. I really wonder. I wonder how many people would really say, yeah, I admire someone who's prudent and intelligent. No, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think, in our dominant culture, I don't think so.
Mm. What do you say? What does anybody else think?
Shrewdness is valued maybe more than wisdom. Cunning and shrewdness.
Shrewdness.
You know, how to make a deal, how to get by, how to maximize, how to this is speaking in a whole different flavor than that. So valuable is in whose eyes?
Okay. You're valuable.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, if you think about somebody who's got lots of money, is very shrewd in business, and has lots of diamonds, silver, gold, whatever, versus somebody who's prudent and wise, people are usually going to say, oh, well, I think the shrewd, rich person is somehow more successful, better in some way.
Well, but yeah. Then if you were to ask, you know, what do I value in my life? Mm-hmm. Those are the things I value more now than ever.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the things that have made, that make my life worth living.
Mm-hmm.
Not all the stuff that I get told I should buy.
I think most people live in a tension between those things. I think like your average person on the street is going to tell you that in their own life they value these things, mm-hmm. and that, but our culture doesn't, mm-hmm. and that they feel like they are forced to value these other things because our culture does, and they have to live in society. Mm-hmm. But if you said, well, what do you value? They're going to tell you, my kids, my family, my church, or you know, whatever that is. So I think most people live in a really difficult tension between those things.
Mm-hmm. I don't think people who tell the truth are particularly valued. And if you think about politics, you would certainly not get elected if you were really telling the truth. And in high likelihood, you would be scorned.
Mm-hmm.
If you truly lived those values.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Learning to be effective.
You want the truth, you can't handle the truth.
Sure. Learning to be effective in saying the truth is a lifelong effort.
Right.
Because just being right is just, that's never going to get you where you need to be.
Right.
Yes. I mean, the question would be, what do they mean by wisdom? And then it might be that some people who have that do value it more than jewels and gold.
Okay.
So what would be?
Well, prudence, intelligence, truth, discernment.
That's what you really think from reading.
Yes, that's how she defines
that's
it.
How,
yeah, insight, strength.
A lot of those are very subjective terms.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, prudence. Well, what is prudence? And
mm-hmm.
what is? Yeah, so those are kind of, they're very difficult to nail down exactly what that is, and it changes, I would imagine, from culture to culture. I imagine that their idea of prudence and insight and discernment is very different from our idea of it.
That's a good point, because it actually, the definitions, I think, change within the book.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about prudence and discernment and give high value to those and say they're difficult to attain. But if you continue reading some of the sayings, you'll find that prudence and discernment may have to do with business dealings. We're back to being shrewd business, how to deal with in society. So it goes in two different directions, and we can read into it what we will.
I'd like your reaction to wisdom is part of creation. It's a third creation story. As you read on in this chapter,
yes.
Start with verse 22, if you want action verbs about wisdom,
mm-hmm.
wow.
Let's go there. Great.
Okay.
That was the next thing. Okay, do you want to start with verse 22? Verse 22, chapter 8.
The Lord created me at the beginning of his work, the first of his acts so long ago.
Linda, could you read 23?
Ages ago, I was set up at the first, before the beginning of the earth.
When there were no depths, I was brought forth. When there were no springs abounding with water.
Before the mountains had been shaped, before the hills, I was brought forth.
When he had not yet made earth and fields, before the world's first hints of soil, bits of soil.
When he established the heavens, I was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep.
When he established the clouds above, when he strengthened the fountains of the deep.
when he made firm the skies above, oh, let's see, when he assigned to the sea its limit, so that the waters might not transgress his command, when he marked out the foundations of the earth.
30. Then I was beside him like a master worker, and I was daily his delight, rejoicing before him always.
Rejoicing in his inhabited world and delighting in the human race. So, you called it a third creation story.
Yeah.
What makes you say that?
Well, I think it's just part of discussions I used to have that I don't go there anymore. There are two creation stories in Genesis.
Right.
This is the third one. It covers all the grounds of the Genesis story.
How does anyone else read it?
Is this wisdom like they're talking?
The Gospel of John.
Yes.
Is this wisdom?
Sounds like wisdom to me.
Yeah. Well, yes, it is wisdom speaking. And the third creation story, I think that's perceptive. It's another variation on it. But one thing to know, though, is that the Lord created me. Actually, it's not the same verb as in Genesis 1. It's a different Hebrew verb, and it could be translated as acquire, bought, okay, possessed,
okay,
or even begot, which throws us into a whole other territory.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because I was sitting here thinking, wow, the Arians were onto something. There was a time when, you know, if we take this to John, then that puts the word as a created thing, and that's trouble. That takes us into heresies that have long been put down and brought back.
Yeah.
So it's tricky ground.
So, okay.
What you said about the Hebrew is helpful.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Anybody else? What else do you notice?
A pre-existent Christ?
Well, in terms of the Hebrew Bible, it's the pre-existent wisdom. Yes, as Christians, we can read it that way. I'm not sure what our Jewish brothers and sisters would say about that.
But it is the precedent we use for Holy Spirit.
Yes.
So this is part of the foundation of the Trinity in traditional Christian theology.
Okay. In verse 23, where it says, ages ago I was set up, this is the same language that gets used for installing the king in Zion, in some of the Psalms. In verse 24, when there were no depths, I was brought forth, which gives this birthing connotation suggestion.
Who's the audience here? What's the context in terms of the timeline? Was this written after the Genesis story?
Yes. Sorry, I didn't say that earlier. Wisdom really came into its own after the Babylonian exile. So that means from about 500 on to the birth of Christ. Prophecy was dead. There were no kings of Israel anymore. If you wanted to participate in religion, you went to the temple and there were long robed priests. So where do you go for instruction? Well, a whole category of sort of a profession of sages, of teachers. That's what this comes out of. And as I mentioned, mostly for young men or for men, period. This really wasn't, the intended audience was not women, which is maybe why they ended up with a female figure. If you're a male reading this, then having the female polarity there. So it's develops for about 500 onward, although it's a very old tradition, and it shows up not just in the story about Solomon, but there are a couple of stories about wise women in 2 Samuel also. So it's a very old tradition, but these professional teachers, literature probably came out from their hands.
Deborah was one of the first judges, as I recall.
Yes, said so, yes.
I mean, there are women leaders.
Yes.
In the history.
Yes, although she's not identified as a wisdom teacher. She's a prophet, she's called a judge, she's a warrior.
She's a military leader.
She's a military leader.
You were talking about the difference or wisdom and knowledge. It sounds like there's a translation as knowledge in this Bible and yours had wisdom. But knowledge, someone who's gone to school a long time, PhD from Harvard, written 17 books, we honor that person. Wow, that person really knows a lot.
Yeah.
But wisdom doesn't necessarily involve education. It's discernment, and
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yes. Yes.
Choices we make, judgments we might make.
Yeah. I think in the book of Proverbs, what we mostly see is this conventional sense of wisdom, in that it is knowing how to get along, go along to get along, or whichever way it goes. Yeah. You know, getting ahead in discernment, more shrewdness. But that doesn't mean that we can't treasure it for these other meanings that we bring to it.
And when you said, in business, the person can be very crude or shrewd,
uh-huh.
and get ahead by wise choices, that shrewdness sometimes can be harmful to people.
Indeed.
And yet, would we call that wisdom? Because they got a lot of money from it, but they did a lot of harm in society.
Good point. What does anybody else say?
I think part of the wisdom tradition, though, would be addressing that particular problem. Always the poor. And if you're going to violate it by being shrewd, you're in trouble, according to the wisdom literature.
Do you think so? I read in Proverbs 10, verse 4, a slack hand causes poverty, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. See, in the conventional wisdom, there was this idea that if you worked hard, you'd get ahead. And the only excuse for being poor was you didn't work hard.
I'm thinking of Siroc.
Okay.
Right. Siroc.
He likes...
You're in trouble if you disrespect the poor. Mm-hmm. Big time. Like Jesus.
Okay. All right.
Then you have the parable of the talents, too. Well, I'm bringing the whole New Testament thing in, but you know, don't go bury it, go be wise about it and make it work and make it do what it's supposed to do.
Make friends with mammon, with unholy
mammon.
So how do you see that fitting into this?
Well, I think it kind of juxtaposes what you're just talking about, which is saying, you know, wealth in itself is not necessarily a bad thing. It's can it be wisely employed for a person's benefit, also for the benefit of a greater good? Is there a wisdom in that?
Huh. Okay.
You know, which is a different twist. No?
Okay. Mm-hmm. Right. Wisdom is not the only female figure in the book of Proverbs. There's also woman folly and the strange woman. The strange woman is a very, sometimes it gets translated alien or foreign. I think she's in chapter 2. Let's see if we can. Chapter 2, verse 16. Unfortunately, the New Revised Standard Version translates it as loose, which has a sexual connotation. But really, it's strange or foreign.
Footnote says strange.
Yeah. Oh. So, verse 16 to 19. Would someone be willing to read?
You will be saved from the loose or strange woman, from the adulteress with her smooth words, who forsakes the partner of her youth, and forgets her sacred covenant, for her way leads down to death, and her paths to the shades. Those who go to her never come back, nor do they regain the path of life.
Her paths lead to the shades. What are they saying about falling? Look, there are Bibles on, if you'd like to. We're in Proverbs.
Oh, I'm Proverbs. Just enjoying this.
Okay.
Well, it's interesting that there's no way back. Like, once you start down the road to Bali.
Yeah, I've come together.
Salvation is not held out here. A turnaround.
Yes, interesting point. And this idea of her feet go down to death, this gets repeated.
That whole passage has echoes of the prophets and the language about Israel, talking about Israel as a loose woman or an adulteress or forsaking the partner and forgetting the covenant. So it's interesting that sort of there's that echo of language about Israel that comes up in that.
Yeah, although now it's instead of the corporate Israel, this is the individual.
Yeah.
This is a signature mark of much of the conventional wisdom, is that it was directed to individuals. And there's not a lot of reference to the Exodus tradition, to Torah, to the corporate body. It's more towards individuals. Individuals. And any other thoughts about woman wisdom or the strange woman?
I thought you were a strange woman.
We're sailing through wisdom today, so let's jump to Ecclesiastes, which has become one of my favorite books in the Bible. We'll see how far we can get.
It's next.
It's next. Okay, we'll start at the very beginning and then leapfrog to the conclusions. Starting with verse 2. Who would like to start us off? We're in Ecclesiastes, first chapter, verse 2.
Vanity of vanities, says the teacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity.
What do people gain from all of the toil at which they toil under the sun?
A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever.
The sun also rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it arose.
The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Round and round goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns.
All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they continue to flow.
All things are wearisome, more than one can express. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, or the ear filled with hearing.
What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun.
Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has been already, it has already been in the ages before us.
The people of long ago are not remembered, nor will they nor will there be any remembrance of people yet to come by those who come after them.
All right. Vanity of vanities. What's the tone of this passage? Isolated?
Desolate.
Desolate.
What's the use?
World weary.
World weary.
Fatalistic.
Depressed.
Depressed.
Let's rewrite verse 4. A bus comes and a bus.
But Holden.
Holden remains forever.
Until the next forest fire.
You know, the word translated vanities, it's hebel in Hebrew, and vanities is an odd translation. I think it also means rubbish, worthless, or airy. Often the teacher uses the expression chasing after the wind or feeding after the wind, feeding on the wind, which doesn't give you much sustenance. So it's...
Tilting at windmills?
Tilting at windmills. Oh, yes, but then there's that Don Quixote moral quandary. But yes, on the surface, I think that's, yeah. He feels, yes, it's like tilting at windmills. Has anyone ever experienced this?
Like, of course. Every day.
Okay. Well, then how do you respond to it? To vanity of vanities, airiness.
Arrogance, is that what you said?
Yeah, airiness, the ephemeral nature of things. There's a good Yiddish term, it's stuce, junk, trash.
I feel sorry for that author, because there's a lot of things that are quite exciting in life and fun to know, and there are new things under the sun that are being invented all the time.
Okay.
And anybody, for example, that's in the field of electronics now knows new things are coming out all the time and will come out even more. And you know what? If you're wrapped up in it, it's an exciting place to be.
Yeah, but that's just more stuff.
But stuff, your comment, it's more stuff, is an attitude and an opinion.
Okay.
And I'm telling you, there are other opinions that say, yeah, this is exciting stuff to study and to know about.
Okay. What I think the author of Ecclesiastes is doing here is he's bringing out the feelings that you say, yes, we've all experienced that, but how many times do we put it out in front and examine that clearly? He goes through, he explains how he sought wisdom. Well, that was just more vanity. He sought riches. He had big houses. He started big projects. And you know what the constant refrain of through Ecclesiastes, he repeats this 6 times, which is that what human beings should do is enjoy their work, enjoy people, it's all in the hands of God. That's surprising when you read this opening, because where he starts is not where he ends up. And so, waltzing through the book of Ecclesiastes, if you turn to chapter 9, that's his philosophical summation, which presents a very different picture.
Now, is this a definition of wisdom, you're saying? Sorry, I missed your introduction.
This belongs in that tradition?
Of which tradition?
Of wisdom teachings.
Yeah.
But to my mind, he's challenging the simple definitions that...
you mean the conventional definitions?
The conventional definitions.
So is he coming up with a new definition of wisdom?
Well, let's read chapter 9 and see where we end up. Because conventional wisdom in Proverbs was, work hard, you'll get ahead. Wasn't so much the ethical issues as individual success. But chapter 9, this is prose. Okay, who would like to start? Verse 1, we'll go through verse 12.
All this I laid to heart, examining it all the righteous and the wise and their deeds are all in the hand of God. Whether it is love or hate, one does not know. Everything that confronts them is vanity. Since the same fate comes to all, to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the evil, well, that's a long verse, to the clean and the unclean, to those who sacrifice and those who do not sacrifice. I'll stop that.
Could someone pick it up?
Did I skip a page?
No. I think I did.
As are the good, so are the sinners. Those who swear are like those who shun an oath. This is an evil in all that happens under the sun, that the same fate comes to everyone. Moreover, the hearts of all are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts where they live, and after that they go to the dead.
But whoever is joined with all the living has hope, for a living dog is better than a dead lion.
The living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. They have no more reward, and even the memory of them is lost.
Their love and their hate and their envy have already perished. They have no more forever any share is all that, and they have no more forever any share in all that is done under the sun.
Go eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works.
Let your garments always be white. Do not let oil be lacking on your head.
Enjoy life with the wife whom you love, all the days of your vain life that are given you under the sun, because that is your portion in life and in your toil at which you toil under the sun.
Whatever your hand finds to do, do with your might. For there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol to which you are going.
Again, I saw that under the sun the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to the skillful, but time and chance happen to them all.
For no one can anticipate the time of disaster, like fish when in a cruel net, and like birds caught in a snare, so mortals are snared of a time and of calamity when it suddenly falls upon them.
Okay. Do you want to go on?
No, let's discuss these 12 chapters. I think it's a good summation of where he arrives. What's his final vision of life?
Can you drink and be merry for tomorrow?
The vanities and the ephemeral nature of life, so what you can do is enjoy what you've got.
Enjoy what you've got. Yeah, no need to strive after riches.
And I think his deconstruction of conventional wisdom is really important, all that stuff about it's not true that good things come to good people, or don't accept that with line and sinker.
It speaks to an uncertainty about life, that rich or poor, we're all subject to that same uncertainty about life. We don't know.
Yes.
Is there going to get caught in a snare? So he uses that analogy. And so it's about presence. It's about being present in where you are and with what you have, and maximizing that. And, we could say, it's vanity to think that we're going to really make an impact on the world, in one sense. And in another sense, we're placed and planted where we are. Mm-hmm. So to embrace that.
Mm-hmm. It also seems fairly Buddhist in terms of non-attachment. You don't get too attached to what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's interesting about this book is that it was written at a time when there was something new under the sun going on. The Jews had returned to Jerusalem. Many had stayed where they were. The Persians controlled the country, and then along came Alexander the Great, who not only conquered the territories militarily, politically, but culturally, bringing a whole new culture, the Greek culture, which mixed with the indigenous culture, and it's generally referred to as Hellenism, but cities, new cities like Alexandria sprung up. In the old cities, the Greeks built amphitheaters. It was a new cosmopolitan influx of Greek philosophy, Greek language. So how Greek came to dominate in Palestine. As a reaction to that, the Jews, the religious establishment circled the wagons. and religion became very rigid. They were kept alive, the religion was kept alive by heavy taxation on the peasants. So the teacher in this book was responding to these two strands. On the one hand, you have this something new, which had created enormous economic upheaval, because the Greeks sort of brought agribusiness to the world, and the peasant farmers were being left in the cold. Large-scale production of goods, so domestic production was being left out, and people were really struggling. But the alternative was this very hidebound religion of the priests and temple sacrifices, and this is the third way that he's proposing. Third way.
We always hear this, and maybe it's somewhere else in Ecclesiastes as well. We always hear this summed up as eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, verse 7 actually says, eat, drink, and be merry, for you're already saved.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
A much nicer.
Yes, I don't think that eat, drink, and tomorrow you die is applicable. That's not right. That's
right.
Not right. No. Because God has long ago approved what you do. So what does that do to this conventional morality? You know, you got to make sure that you don't consort with strange women. You'll get a bad name. It's not good.
Well, it sure shifts it. I mean, it shifts it from the abstract to the real. I mean, it doesn't.
Amen.
To me, it doesn't imply a jettisoning of morality, but that it be brought down to the day-to-day act, moment-to-moment level.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, it doesn't, you know, rather than make actions that maybe are cold or abstracted,
mm-hmm.
my interactions that I have with my environment, my friends, my community, really are where the morality happens.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think this is an endorsement of hedonism by any means, because
mm-hmm.
he's talking about eat your bread with enjoyment. So there's a
yes.
sense of what is entitled to you, or what you have produced, or what you have, but you know, what you have accomplished. Take enjoyment in that.
Yes.
Drink your wine with a merry heart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then later on it talks about enjoying the, speaking to the male, but enjoy the wife of your, you know, enjoy
yes.
your relationship. It's,
yes.
It's there's some boundaries around there, some, you know, assumptions about, it's not just go out and take whatever you want and do whatever you please to
mm-hmm.
whoever. It's not
good
that
point.
At all.
I think that's a wonderful chapter, of course, this particular
mm-hmm.
one. And that the same calamity comes on the good and the bad. I mean, it gets you out of that moral, the good
mm-hmm.
people get all the good stuff,
mm-hmm.
the bad people get
mm-hmm.
all the... And speaking now as a Lutheran understanding here, and Luther would have seen this, known this by heart,
mm-hmm.
That you're simultaneously a saint and a sinner.
Mm-hmm.
And in cartoons, we always have the little angel and the little devil.
Mm-hmm.
So and Solzhenitsyn, who just died, his big understanding of the evil of great systems was,
mm-hmm.
it's in you individually, and you're always moving from one to the other, and you don't always know if you're doing good or bad
mm-hmm.
until... you know, live it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me Ecclesiastes is always saying live it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's a profound thing given the world that you and I go back to, which makes divisions between. I just came from Appleton, Wisconsin, where Tribent sits in an old farm, and that's, I have insurance with them. But the my sister lives in one of these what I would call almost god-awful developments of houses with six bathrooms, you know. I mean, how many bathrooms do you need for two kids? But, you know, that kind of thing. And the vanity of it. But also then, how do you enjoy it?
Yeah.
Same time.
Well, maybe if you enjoyed one bathroom, you wouldn't need
six. It seems like
you should
be able to.
If you really enjoyed one, you know, it might be enough.
And one roll of toilet paper.
Well, our time has come to the end, and I realize we've raced through this literature. I hope you'll go back and spend some time in Proverbs, also Triumph Ben Sirach, or the Wisdom of Solomon, and Ecclesiastes. Job is a whole other story. We could spend weeks on Job, so that's why I haven't touched on Job. But I appreciate your contributions. I always learn so much from these. So have a wonderful stay.
Thank you.
Thank you.